Welcome to the Teach, Lead, Innovate podcast, where we dive deep into the heart of innovation, leadership, and transformative ideas shaping the future of education and technology. Each episode is a journey into the minds of visionary educators, thinkers, and leaders who are not just talking about change, they're living it. Real people leading real change. This is where passion meets practice and ideas come to life. Welcome to the Teach, Lead, Innovate podcast. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Teach, Lead, Innovate podcast. I am very excited to welcome to the show today, Dr. Josue Falez. Dr. Falez is the CEO of Gomo Educational Services, a keynote speaker, former partner at Education Elements, director of the Rutgers University Institute for Improving Student Achievement, and EduMatch author. He is truly an accomplished educator and innovator, and we are so happy to have him as a guest today. Welcome to the Teach, Lead, Innovate podcast, Dr. Falez.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you on today. So, Dr. Falez, can you share a bit about your journey in education? What have been some of the roles that you have worked in as an educator?
So let me go even prior to education. I served as a military police officer in the Army, serving as active duty. I was stationed in Leavenworth, Kansas, and I mainly went there for the GI Bill. From there, I wanted to go back to school to work in medicine. And when I was working, finished my bachelor's, I started a master's in biology. Then I was going to do a master's in biomedical science, but then I couldn't get a fellowship that I really wanted. So my mom was like, why don't you like be a substitute teacher? That way it could give you some funds. And while I started subbing, that's when I realized my passion. And I just knew that no matter what, I wanted to become a doctor. And it was like, while I worked on, you know, substitute teaching, was going to school at night for, you know, master's in teaching, and then became assistant principal for a year. Then I was a principal. I did it for 14 years. Got my doctorate while I was a principal, and then became assistant superintendent. From there, I went on to become work at Rutgers Grad School of Education as the director for Rutgers Improving Student Achievement. That is what allowed me to get more of the footprint that I have now. So all of this experience helped me now as a business owner, where I now support school districts, was across the country, but now we're moving international.
That's outstanding. And I know you are a wealth of information. So that's why I want to focus today on social and emotional learning, SEL, restorative practices, and culturally responsive leadership. So before we even start into that, I know you just returned from the Gambia. What brought you there and how was it? The pictures online looked phenomenal.
Thank you so much. So it started with an idea where Gomo was looking to expand internationally. And I would say about a few years, several years ago through Rutgers, I was actually trying to prepare a principal to superintendent leadership like exchange program in South Africa. And someone who was one of our consultants who was actually from the Gambia was like, we need to bring Gomo to the Gambia. And we titled it Gomo in the Gambia, as far as like this, just hyping it up. We kept it very quiet as far as campaigning until we arrived to the country. So no one knew anything outside of the company. And what it allowed us to do is partner with a nonprofit foundation called the NAMI Foundation, which I happen to be a board member, but our CEO or the chairman of the foundation is Alhassan Suso, and he's very influential in the U.S. but also in Gambia, because he was a 2019 New York State Teacher of the Year, 2020 Horace Mann Educator of the Year, 2020 NEA National Education Teacher of the Year, and he's Gambian, has a book that is they use it within their curriculum, and he wanted to really start uplifting and improving literacy in the country. So there's a number of partnerships that are operating through the NAMI Foundation. And we're filtering with the Ministry of Education, the Gambia Teachers Union, the government, meaning the president, vice president, and a number of other entities. And that allowed us to be able just to segue in. So I was presenting to teachers from across the region, like all of the country. There were principals part of this session, and we were presenting at the University of the Gambia, so which is like their Harvard University for the Gambia. And it was the session I chose to present was on restoration in the Gambia, because of all the oppression that happens in basically all the African countries, when we want to uplift the people, we want to highlight the great work that's being done, but we also want to be able to help raise voices for students who are not being recognized because there's so much disparity from the rural area to the city area. So it's talking about just restoration and looking at how do we band with the varying cultural values to see each other for who they are and then to help build positive relationships. So that's where it was an integration of SEL, cultural values, as well as restorative all in one work in one session with everyone. And I don't know if you saw some of the some of the clips that people had never met each other from all across the country, from whether you're a principal, paraprofessional, all the way to principal to executive level. I mean, they were at the end hugging each other, and it was unprompted. So to me, that's how powerful, like, I keep saying, like, hashtag YGOMO, but that's the reason why I want to be able to expand the impact, the footprint of what GOMO does to anyone and everyone that wants it around the world.
Yeah, we're looking at international now.
This is international. Anywhere around the world.
That's amazing.
If you want GOMO, we will be there for you and work alongside you to be able to help that collective impact.
That's amazing. So I have a question for you, Dr. Feliz. How has your personal or professional background influenced your views on the importance of SEL and culturally responsive leadership in the field?
So one is when we say SEL, I just want to clearly highlight the competencies, the five competencies of self-awareness, self-management, to manage responsibilities, responsible decision-making, and social awareness. If you are unaware of yourself and how to manage yourself, you're unable to go manage someone else. And if these are things that we're asking not only teachers, but also leaders to be able to oversee children, when you don't have those skills or that skill set, you're oppressing others sometimes without even knowing. Mm-hmm. And I remember learning at Harvard that the most dangerous people are the ones that don't know they don't know. So you could be doing something and you are oppressing others and just you're totally unaware. It's not your intention. And in some cases, these unintentional things is what we call the microaggressions, the self-implicit bias. You're well-intentioned, but then because of your lack of awareness, you're causing harm. And now that's where, to me, like being aware of culture, a cultural awareness. We do a lot of work on cultural competency, cultural responsiveness by being immersed, becoming aware, empowering, help raise voice. That is where you really start the movement towards helping individuals because you acknowledge things about their differences in cultures and backgrounds. And that way you're addressing all of the SEL competencies, all the different cultural aspects. And then you're restoring whatever harm has been caused because regardless of who you are, wherever you are, whatever space you occupy, there has been harm caused to you. And, you know, just because you're part of the dominant group doesn't mean that you're just left alone. So everyone has had some sort of harm because it's always at some point someone that's more powerful than you that's oppressing.
I appreciate you really explaining that. It makes perfect sense. And so in your view, what do you think are some of the most pressing equity issues in the educational system today?
The most pressing thing that does not get much airway is policy.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you see that we're seeing or hearing the certain groups are being oppressed, the policy allows that way.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is just the propaganda against equity So certain groups can feel comfortable, and it's more than race, because, and I want to look at not just equity, called an equity, but educational equity. Mm-hmm. When we're addressing all student needs, where we're looking at the different isms of, you know, and beyond race, you know, gender, religion, class, age, ableism, like the ability levels, so many more. And once their groups of individuals, when you look at, break down your data, that they're being oppressed, and even more so historically underrepresented and marginalized, that's where we can look at what is our policy state, and how does that make it easier to oppress those individuals, you know, long term. So that's the first thing. And then the propaganda just basically further perpetuates, because it's easier to continue with the status quo. And unfortunately, it's that minority group that has the loudest voice. And what we're saying is that we're trying to always bridge this academic achievement gap. But even more so, when we talk about this opportunity gap, if certain mm-hmm. the groups who've been historically marginalized, underrepresented, never had the opportunity, the access to certain things and resources, then that not just achievement gap, but the opportunity gap is going to always continue to exist. And therefore, you will never be able to achieve equity. And then so many other things keep spilling down from just that. And it's like, how do we kind of address that? So if we can address policy, to me, that's one of the biggest things, by dismantling it, looking at the structures that are set there. Like we have this policy network where we do just that, dismantle, you know, critique, form new policy, shows you how it perpetuates inequalities. And then you work your way backwards to see how it ultimately, how do you implement this policy into practice? And obviously where you're piloting certain things to see where it works, because it has to be organic. And it separates, I know, like in the state of New Jersey, there's policy that is basically purchased from companies called Strauss-Esme, where you can basically put your title on it, your school district logo. But then districts now are stepping up, and in this, you know, I wouldn't say all of them, but they're really trying to do certain things different. And they're just going down to the work, like, what do we need to do with our policy? How do we critique it? How do we revise it? Having the stakeholders part of it and changing it, but it's going to be a multi-year process. So when you're doing all this work regarding equity, there has to be time that's invested, and know that it's not going to be overnight. So what you're willing to invest the time, obviously you have to finance everything, because there's going to be a cost. Not just monetary, but then just burden on you. This equity work is difficult. And that's another piece where, when people realize how much work, time, effort, energy that goes into the real equity work, it sometimes causes individuals to sway. But it's necessary work to be able to help, again, those that need the most.
Would you say that when it comes to policy, these deficiencies exist at the local, state, and national levels?
That is correct, because when you look at this policy work, it, at least in the U.S., it does filter down from the federal to the state statutes and codes, which ultimately guides district policies, and then even schools' manuals. And if we need to do it, we need to start from the start, from the top, and then drill our ways back down to see what is real need. However, there are states that do not fully apply to the federal policies, which means that they have some more leeway. So, for example, there are states where the principal's in charge of policy. The actual principal can go straight to state legislation. There are states in our country which can do that, whereas other states like New Jersey, it's your board that actually helps with legislation. So it's leveraging the knowledge of where you're at to be able to do that that kind of work. And again, it takes time, it takes energy, and it takes effort to be able to see and make real change.
As you're talking, and you talked earlier about like the cost of all this, you could argue the cost of not doing it is even higher, you know?
That is correct.
There's a great deal today of discussion regarding restorative practices. So I have a two-part question for you. First, why do you think it's important that schools begin implementing these practices in their day-to-day? And then secondly, what can school leaders do to build greater buy-in and support for these practices among their staff?
So out of the number of districts, and we're talking well over 100 districts that we work with, there are the highest number of contracts that we do work with districts is either culture or restorative work. And in some cases, I don't see a difference because where there are places that you lack cultural awareness, cultural competency, cultural responsiveness, you have more disciplinary actions upon certain groups. Now, and I mention that because out of 100% of the districts that we work with, 100%, if there is a certain group, a number or percentage of students of color or historically marginalized groups, they are punished or disciplined more than the other group, which, you know, they are the minority, 100% of the time. So if every single school district across the country and even world says that they're all about students first, empowering students for the future, for life, if you are, you know, knowledgeably and intentionally knowing that this historically underrepresented marginalized group is constantly being punished, in some cases more severely, with high level of recidivism, what are we going to do differently if we're saying we're all about and for the children? So that is the ultimate reason why there is a need, cut and dry. And again, this is what I see. So, and it's to the point where I even get phone calls like, this is about to hit the paper or the news. What can you do for us? We get calls for that. The question is, how can you be proactive? And this is where you're talking about the administration. If this has been taking place, and let's say you're new to the school, as I'm working with a number of, you know, principals, even assistant soups or superintendents, like, how, especially if you're just stepping in, how can you be proactive with that? So now it's looking at what is the mission and vision? How does it align to our expectation, like for real? And then what are those next steps? And if culture and restorative, culture responsiveness or competence, at least starting off is responsiveness, excuse me, cultural competence first, then you more to me responsive and then cultural proficiency. That should be the progression. And then how do we help? And it's not just restorative practice, like per se, but then to leverage the buy-in, we start off with just restorative approaches. And that's just how do you talk to people? And then setting hints of things with just establishing positive relationships. And then let's get into the restorative practice. And the purpose of that is there is the highest percentage of students that's suspended in school systems. If I had to ask you that question, what grade level would you or age level would you think that would be? I'm asking you that now, Dave.
Cool. I would think high school level, the secondary level.
And that's a lot of people actually think that. Through research, a number amount of research is actually pre-K.
Really?
And I know I'm blowing your brain. There's a number amount of research that we do present on that. And the concern is that once students step in, especially at the age of 3 to 4 years old, they're being suspended because if you don't know what to do and the students aren't like acclimated to school at that age, you just put them out. Now, there are schemes, meaning you can say, I'm keeping the child home for today, just come back tomorrow, keep them up for a few days, you're dealing with the parents. There are schemes around it to kind of decrease that level, but there's state legislations because of that fact across a number of states because it was so high. And again, New Jersey is one of those states that happened up to from pre-K to grades two because they wanted to stop that sort of pipeline because that's the beginning of the prison, the school to prison pipeline. So when you start that, you're now having students more apt and accustomed to dealing with the justice system because if they're out, they're now going out in the streets, dealing with, you know, just things outside of what they could be doing in school. And then that could lead them to more behavioral challenges. And that's what starts that cycle. And again, if they're doing that, they're raising children that same exact way. And now we have generation or generations of students because of just we could have started with the grades pre-K to two by just keeping them in school. That was one of the legislation started with the recess between grades to two in 2017. Again, I'm just speaking of New Jersey because we're both teachers. So that way people are aware. That was the impetus for the law and the act.
I got to say, the idea of pre-K being that grade, like, that did really blow my mind. I can't even imagine I guess this is why legislation exists, what toll that must have on a child, especially a child. I can't imagine that, the long-term consequences of that. So that's, wow.
Well, that led to a lot of disparities that we're seeing, and especially between the Black and Brown Hispanics and mm-hmm. their other race counterparts or ethnic counterparts. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's a at least, again, I'm speaking mostly about state New Jersey, there's a disproportionality requirements for districts that have those disparities. They have more difficult within certain groups. This taking place right now because they want to see a difference, a real difference in those school districts so that again, that's now decreasing not just the achievement gap, but then the opportunity gap.
What I like too that you said earlier, and I go to always, is it seemed like the first step that you have to do before you even go into restorative practices is relationship, is forming those relationships.
That is correct. But it's difficult for some people. I've been in education 20 years. I've been 30 years, 40 years. Now, we want to get into where we've been, and I keep telling people, we are in the people business. So you want to be able to see how many relationships that you can establish, you know, for the greater good of all your students, not just be in a position to do the work.
So let's say you have a school and they began implementing restorative practices, SEL, culturally responsive initiatives. How do you think schools can effectively measure their effectiveness to ensure that they're improving and they're moving forward?
Well, there's many measures. A number of school districts have, you know, climate culture surveys that they're doing pre to post. You have you're measuring your discipline by month. I remember when I was a principal, we used to track our discipline by month, even by location. With the positive behavior support in schools. And now, I mentioned PBSIS or positive behavior support in schools only because we used to kind of track the data so we could see the decline. Like, we actually had a significant decline in our results when I was principal last. So that allowed us to see quantitatively where we're at. But even more so when you're looking at school performance reports cards that say, like, over years, where you're seeing a decline in the discipline. And then if you see more of an increase in, like, when students are not being disciplined, you're able to do even more positive things. So if you have an increase in clubs, mm-hmm. you have an increase in school pride activities that you're doing, you're seeing the evidence on social media. So it's not fake, but it's real. Like, people are seeing real time. What are students saying about your school district, not only in certain platforms as far as, like, rating, but also on social media as far as what they're experiencing. So those are things that you can actually measure both quantitatively and quality.
So I want to transition a little bit to technology, okay? If we take a look out in the news, we've got robust technologies coming about. We've got AI. How do you envision the future of education with those ongoing advancements?
Wow. I would say this first, as a business owner, I was mm-hmm. somewhat reluctant to try to use AI. However, AI is making it much easier for me with a number of things. And I'm only using it as a thought starter, some things that I may have in my head, but it puts it to paper. And I just keep digging deeper into some of the deeper systems or operating thoughts about that topic. And I'm able to, like, you know, really jump forward. And I've been able to save a significant amount of time with just developing things, because we do design things authentically for school districts based on, you know, based on their need. So when I look at that from AI, and I just remember things like Study Island. That was one of the early ones that when I was a principal, we used to Study Island. Scholastic had, there was a number of different after-school programs. So based on how the students performed, it geared the lessons or the tests according to their need. And when we're looking for differentiation, technology offers it. However, nothing can replace a teacher. And that's where I talk about the people business. So it should be the teacher that's amplifying the person while differentiating based on need. So when students have questions, they can deal with the expert in the teacher, but then as they're looking to remediate, that's where they can use the AI. So again, nothing can replace the teacher. So that's why I want to make sure that technology will never, ever replace a teacher. So as long as we can leverage that, meaning the teacher is going to be the overall chief energy officer, chief information chief officer to the students. And they are just like the principal is a chief energy officer to school. So to me, like, you can never replace a principal. So a computer technology will never be able to replace a principal. There's certain things that a human being can offer that a computer cannot. So those are two irreplaceable positions, like a nurse. So there's certain common goals with this distributing that only a nurse can offer. Again, the distribution may be a medicine or certain things that you can use the tool, and that's the technology, the tool. But then the human being is the one who's able to be able to see a number of different things in the other human being.
And I love that, because I think so many times the fear is amongst educators that with emerging technologies that pretty soon we're not going to need teachers. We do. We are a people business. And if we take a look at the trends and what's going on, we need those relationships more than ever. So
and think about it.
Yeah.
Who codes those the technology, the tool,
people.
The human beings?
Exactly. Now, here's a question. Can technology play a role, do you think, in advancing restorative practices and equity in education?
I would say not right now and not in the near future.
Why?
Because human beings are different. And back to where I said that human beings are ones who create the codes for the technology. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a range of emotions to be able to deal with individuals. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the population, no matter how much we say that technology is going to replace human beings, people love dealing with other human beings more than technology. And it's more than just looking at social media and clicking off. We're talking about people having emotional issues, psychological issues, and they just need that human being, a touch, the empathy that a computer cannot provide, the social awareness that a computer cannot provide. So those are reasons why I believe that AI can, at least I was going to say right now, even in the near future, cannot be able to do that. There are things that like even operating a circle where I'm training on how to discuss the values, a computer, and it's looking at varying values that I there's no way that the computer can end up doing that again, especially right now. When we're doing opening and closing circles, we're talking about just uplifting each other. Right now, a computer cannot be able to do that because it's moments like the timing. If you're talking too much or talking too little, someone needs to be able to intervene. Whereas a computer, when you code it, it's like, you know, 15 minutes you're introducing, in another 10 minutes you're maybe going to answer questions, and then another 10 minutes. So that would be more perfunctory. So whereas when you're in person live, how the conversations take place, there are people that are sharing some really deep things that the computer cannot be able to display some empathy, whereas a human being does, and I do. Those are things that I believe that a computer cannot be able to display, again, at the moment.
Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Phyllis. I would have to agree with you 100% on that. So as we've discussed, I know you are the CEO of GOMO Educational Services. Can you tell us more about what GOMO offers and what it can do? What are the services?
So we are an institute that provides PD and executive level training to anyone and everyone that deals with children, both directly and indirectly. And we have this vision of becoming this premier PD institute that's about empowering agency and voice in adults so they can do the same for children. So basically everything we do, we model so that admin can do with admin can do with teachers, and teachers can do with students like next day. There's many platforms that we work on. So things from network building, where you come in as a network over time. There's conferences, keynotes. There's a 1 hour keynotes to your staff, regardless of size. We are executive leadership coaching. So any leaders would need some help. We do community talks. Those are conversations with your community at night. We have program design for private clients. I mean, there's a host of things that we do, and it keeps evolving. So like things like student keynotes. We started with just adult keynotes, and then a few districts were saying that there were some challenges they were having. So do we do keynotes because they just loved our company? Then we started just doing student keynotes, and then, you know, we've been really selling that as a part of another platform also. We do those like 45 minutes and you know, we do up to 5 sessions, and we've been having extremely positive feedback from that, and even our keynotes, because we're guaranteeing to be able to help move every single person that's going to be part of our session, the hour session, as far as looking to see change where everyone can be there all one shot. So, and again, anything that we don't have, we can design for you to authentically. And I say all that because we've evolved to becoming a solutions-based company. And I mentioned that because we did talk about equity. We did talk about restorative. We did talk about SEL and a little bit of technology. We are more than just those 4 things. So if there's a challenge you need, even leadership, we're about to start a number of leadership presentations in districts. So what are your needs? You believe GOMO can handle it? We will willingly and readily accept your challenge to support, guide, and uplift you and your school districts anywhere around the world.
That's outstanding. So I have one more final question for you, Dr. Phyllis. How can listeners learn more about your work or get in touch with you if they're interested in GOMO Educational Services?
So they can actually go to the website, GOMOED Services with an S.com. So that is GOMOED Services with an S.com. And that'll allow you, one, to see just the website, that see the types of offerings that we have. And there's a contact form that is on the website that you can fill out, which will trigger someone from our team to reach out to you. For the most part, it is triggered. We do reach out, some cases the same day, in some cases within an hour. That leads people to realizing the type of relationship that we have and intimacy that we have with our district partners. And that is just another thing as far as like why I keep saying, why GOMO? And you can speak to any of our current and previous clients that they say why GOMO also. And also reach out on our social media platforms by DMing at GOMO, GOMOEDS, that is on X, Instagram, and Facebook at GOMOEDS. And then on LinkedIn, it is GOMO Educational Services. These are other ways and strategies to be able to reach out to us so we can partner with you in one shape or form, again, wherever you're at.
That's awesome. You definitely have that footprint there on social media. So there's no excuses. People can get in touch with you. Well, thank you, Dr. Phyllis, for coming on to the Teach, Lead, Innovate podcast today. It has truly been a pleasure having you, and I am certain that you will continue to be an innovator in the field.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Oh, my pleasure. All right, everyone, until we meet again, stay inspired, stay positive, and have the best day ever.